Welcome to Sideshow on 2RPH. Today we have Kerina Stammel. Kerina is an actor and dancer. She's Sydney-born and trained both in the UK and in Australia, and has appeared in films like Moulin Rouge, on TV shows like The Serpent Queen, and on stage. She's even been on Play School. Currently, she's playing Kirsty Miller on British soap Doctors. Kerina, thank you so much for joining me on Sideshow. So, hey, how is life treating you on a soap, and how is it different from your other jobs?
It is radically different. I can't tell you. I mean, I think I've learnt more doing a year and a half of a daytime soap than I have over my 20-year acting career. So imagine rocking up to work, and the only way I can describe it is it's like there's a printing press that's constantly just pushing out paper, and you're grabbing the pages, digesting them as quickly as possible, interpreting them, delivering a performance, and then it's next. So it's the fastest I've ever worked in my entire acting career. And Doctors is notoriously famous for being, I think, one of the fastest ones that's shot in the UK. So, yeah, you are, as one of the lovely established actresses, Elizabeth Dermott Walsh, said to me, flying by the seat of your pants, or as she termed it, going to work every day without any pants on.
Right. Okay.
So that is really how it feels. Also, it's interesting as well because you've got a fan base that are, they're lovely and, you know, the show means so much to them, but they're kind of like a little bit, they make me think a little bit of like people that are obsessive about Dungeons and Dragons. Like, it's their world, their rules, their people that they like and dislike, and their emotions and relationship to the show are really close to the surface, and there's a real sense of ownership around the show and the shared experiences it gives them with other fans and other people who watch the show, which is also a really different experience as an actor, because you're dealing with a different kind of feedback, different intensity with the commenting online. You know, whereas I've done loads of TV shows where I've been, you know, basically like a guest artist. You come, you do an episode, you knock out a performance. It's a lovely story told over 6 to 8 episodes. And there are some people that really love the work and really love what you've done, but it's not the same kind of group of people necessarily really hyper-focusing on sort of, you know, the minutiae of a show, for example.
Yeah, because, you know, it's been running for decades, hasn't it?
Yeah, and our audience, I mean, we rate very well. We get, I think, 30% of the television share during our daytime slot, which is amazing given the state of terrestrial TV these days compared to sort of streaming. And because it rates so well, getting 30% of the audience at that time, you've kind of, it's a shared experience. So I think there's something about that, and also about the demographic of our audience, who, you know, are people that are at home watching something in the middle of the day, that there's an investment in that show to kind of give them access to the outside world storytelling. They want something that is challenging but also a little bit safe. Like, it's doing something very specifically for a demographic, as you know, at the same time. And I think their investment in us is very passionate, and they give themselves over to it a lot.
And so how many episodes are you making a year?
God, I don't know the total a year, but we will shoot 3 episodes over 7 work days, and there are usually 2 blocks running. So a block is sort of a team that are working in over the 7 days, and we'll have 2 concurrent blocks at least running. So that's shooting 6 episodes every 7 days with 2 different teams. And then once a year they'll triple bank, where they add another block. So you might be across 9 episodes being shot within a 7-day period if you're an actor moving between the blocks.
Wow, that's so
it's
intense.
A lot. Like, I know we're up to 200 and something at the moment. It's the one that I remember most recently reading. So, yeah, we've been, each season, you know, there's a large number of eps that come out.
Wow. And how many takes do you get in your scenes?
Well, this was the thing that was such an interesting thing to learn. If they can get it in one, they'll get it in one, but you know, often there might be a boom or something and you'll redo it. When you're an actor, you've kind of got to hold your can we do that again moments for when you really need to do it again. Like, you can't be doing it again all the time. But I reckon, gosh, I feel like sometimes it's definitely just one, like bang off the mark, and then sometimes two, three. Wow. But it's fast. We work really quick.
Wow. Yeah.
And that's what I mean. Like, you've got to park your ego and your inhibitions at the door because there's no time.
Yeah.
And there's no time to be precious.
No, no. Now, look, I know we'll have some emerging performers listening to the show. Can you tell me a little bit about your training?
Well, it's interesting for me because I'm 42. So I believe I was one of the first generations in Australia with a disability to expect to attend mainstream schooling, to be integrated and not sort of sent off to special school. Even that, I mean, I've got stories of my parents where there was a primary school teacher who openly refused to teach me because of my dwarfism. Those sorts of things were happening behind the scenes. I mean, right at the beginning of, I just mean regular education. And then we've all got our story from our very first school play. I mean, there's girls famously, apparently, it's one of the moments they clock whether they're pretty or not because of the way that, you know, the primary school play is cast. And, you know, so I went through school with some of those things happening when I was very young behind the scenes and at that point unaware of them. And then by the time I got through to university, where I know there'd been a few real bright stars that have kind of being disabled and come through Australian universities, but, you know, going to university and being there with a visible difference was really quite challenging and isolating. And, I mean, right up until the late 90s when I auditioned for one of Australia's leading drama schools, you know, I was openly told at the audition when I got through to the penultimate round of selection that there was no point training a dwarf.
Right.
Which was really, on one hand, I mean, the discrimination's terrible. That's a given. It shouldn't happen. But weirdly, because it was so overt, it was also freeing because it made me look elsewhere in that if that's the core belief of the people that are meant to be training me, what could I possibly learn from them? Because I'd be meeting discrimination and barriers every time I went in. I'd be showing them how human I was every time I was performing rather than coming away with a great skill set. So that was part of the impetus for me to actually leave the country and look elsewhere, because the disability rights movement had happened in the UK, the big one, in 1995, where people had campaigned for access to public transport and things, and there was a real push in the late 90s, early noughties to improve the representation of people with disabilities on screen. So it was actually a really fortunate time for me to kind of jump ship. Also, the internet had been invented and was still relatively new and exciting, which meant I, for a sweet period in history, was able to email directors on the other side of the globe who were maybe thinking a little bit more diversely and progressively, and then physically post a digital videotape of me auditioning. So, you know, that was kind of how I was being seen by them. And then that led to work in England and Europe, which just basically didn't stop. And once I was over here, I went to Lambda. I was accepted into one of their full-time training courses. But as an overseas foreign student at the time, I think in like 2003, it would have cost about £30,000 to do the course, which was just not feasible for my family.
So much money.
I remember bawling my eyes and manipulating my dad nearly into mortgaging the house to allow me to do it. And my dad was nearly manipulated, and he just said to me on the phone, "Darling, when you become an actor," I mean, I was acting at the time, but he's like, you know, "with your future acting career, do you think you will ever be able to pay off this mortgage that I take on the house?" And I remember at that point just suddenly stopping the manipulative crocodile tears and going, "Do you know what, Dad? I'll just start working. It's fine. I won't do the full-time course at drama school." But I did cobble together my training basically from the late 90s through to, even now I do things to top it up, but short courses. So I did Shakespearean and Jacobean plays at Lambda for a solid 8 weeks in the UK. And that was also my introduction kind of to London. It gave me enough of a taster of drama school to kind of steal what I needed to steal as knowledge, and also work out what I maybe wanted more of myself in terms of my own training and career development. And, you know, I went to the Actors Centre in Australia when I was there, did every play that I could kind of feasibly be cast in at university, which was, again, hard because even at that point at uni in Sydney, you had young men and women that were casting. I mean, yeah, sure, they were my age, but they were still affected by all the ableism in society. And, you know, I wouldn't get a look in at some auditions because I knew that there'd be a hot, you know, director that was basically just wanting to cast his next girlfriend.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, that sort of drama at uni, you've got to kind of have a, you know, a very honest perspective of these things. And so, yeah, I put together as much training as I could and then got loads of experience with a company in London called Grey Eye Theatre Company, which were a disability-led theatre company, as well as meeting every director that was open to having a conversation with me and getting the ball rolling that way.
Now, I know you did a secondment at Grey Eye at one point. I think that's so interesting. It's such an interesting company. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, what was great about the secondment and Grey Eye wasn't just the fact that it was giving me access to stage time, a tour, and, you know, really letting me sit in on rehearsal processes, but I met loads of disabled people, loads of different bodies, loads of different neurological conditions and, you know, people dealing with all sorts of different situations, sensory impairments, physical, you name it. And that was really what forged my disability politics and sense of identity, which in the 90s, growing up in a fairly middle-class family in Sydney, I had an idea that I was being treated badly. I'd had, socially, I'd had experiences where primary school teachers had refused to teach me. I'd had awkward moments at university where lecturers have come out with really shocking statements about me in front of the class, things like that. So I had a really strong sense of justice while I was in Australia and what I wanted to change and how I wanted to be treated. But I felt in many ways alone in that, except for the blessing actually that my siblings have the same disability as myself, which gave me a little bit of a shared experience, particularly about my ideology around representation and how important that is. But I didn't really find a disabled community until I came to England and had met people that had chained themselves to buses and insisted on the development of ramps to access a bus. And I think the difference was they had all been, the generation just above me had all been in the UK sent to special schools. So they knew one another when they were kind of ghettoized in education. The civil rights movement kind of happened. They got swept up along in that. They then accessed university and, you know, there was a deregulation of institutions. So a lot of people were integrated into society, or some of the awesome people I met were famously busting friends out from institutions. You know, people who'd been put away by the, I'm using quote marks here because I know the language is inappropriate, but it was of the time, you know, the spastic society, you know, people were in their housing development stuck. And at the time, the charities, because that was a source of income for the charity, providing a service for the government, you know, they were saying, oh, don't worry about building accessible housing socially. You know, we've got the people here in comfortable, you know, institutionalized accommodation. And whereas the disability rights movement was like, no, we want to be able to buy a house or live where we want to live or live outside of an institutional situation. And I'd never come across that before because I was, I think, generationally in a weird spot as an Australian who, it was great, I was, you know, integrated into my local mainstream schools. I became vice captain of my high school. There are things I look back and realise were inaccessible to me that maybe, you know, really disadvantaged my education that I didn't have insight into until suddenly in my mid-20s I went, oh, my God, maybe the fact I couldn't reach anything in the science lab really had an impact on my HSC levels when I was trying to do science and physics, and that's why I dropped out of those subjects. Like, but I didn't realise that until my 20s and went, oh, my God, the height of science labs or a social construction. I didn't have access to any of that. I really had a hard time at school retrospectively, or remembering that even when I walked to my HSC exam, you know, some awful adults, you know, apropos of nothing, leant out of their car as they drove past me and shouted the M word at me. So, you know, I'm 5 minutes away from walking into major exams at high school, and I've just been, you know, experienced some serious ableist abuse that's really upsetting. But I'm like, nope, got to put that in a box and do this maths test, and did very well. But you go, that's got to have taken a couple of points off, because that would have been in the back of my mind while I was pumped full of adrenaline. So, you know, there are things like that that I didn't have insight into until I was much older and outside looking back. And my parents are lovely, bright, thoughtful, caring, loving people who were both teachers themselves. So I think, how did they not look at the science lab and go, oh, that'll be tricky for Kirana? But then you realize nobody can know anybody else's body or experience, and it was completely new to them. And but it's like they can't have seen it.
No, exactly. And we're all swimming in ableist soup. So we're all not aware of, and I think about some of those things as well. Like, I did really well at visual arts when I was younger, and as soon as I got older and the workload got bigger, I couldn't do that level of work with my hands because my hands mm-hmm. would just get too sore. And so I went from getting an A in art to failing art because I just didn't have enough working documents. And I just thought I was lazy and I'd messed up. And actually, it wasn't that at all. It was that the workload had tripled, and I couldn't do that amount of work with the hands that I had. So, I completely understand that.
And, you know, you think it's obvious as well when somebody's got like a visibly really obvious impairment. You realize people have absolutely no idea. So, you know, I've got a lot of empathy too when people kind of, you know, are ticking the invisible disability box, because it's like, if people can look at me, who's 3 foot tall in a standard kitchen, which did happen when I was applying for a grant to get my kitchen adapted, and go, what's the problem? what I don't understand why this kitchen doesn't work for you. And I'm like, because everything is higher than my head. I just think, oh, you know, we haven't even got near the edges of dealing with stuff that people can't overtly see.
So how do you deal with your working life now? Do you think there are big differences mm-hmm. working with a disability in the UK and in Australia?
Yes. So I did have jobs in Australia that were mostly office-based. I did do acting work in Australia, but a lot of the acting work I got, I was really lucky. Like Moulin Rouge, for example, ended up lasting for months. So I was going to the same studio day on day, which meant I kind of did have a certain level of control around the environment that I was in. So things that may have been inaccessible to me, like, for example, there's no way with my short arms I would have been able to lace myself up into a corset. Well, no one really can lace themselves up into a corset. So there were loads of, you know, costume people around who that was their job, to help you in and out of those things. So it was interesting in that, and also actually I was working so hard and had such a nice role in it that a runner would bring the lunch to you. So there were things that sort of weren't a problem, but they were accidentally not a problem. My ordinary workplaces, I just took steps everywhere. But also it's tricky because I was sort of in my early 20s or late teens when I was working in Australia. I was really comfortable with, at that point, being physically uncomfortable and keeping everybody else comfortable in the workplace. What I've noticed in England, where I've now been working for the last 20 years, not only have they got an excellent program called Access to Work, which means I apply for a budget each year and I can employ an access support worker, which I do, and they're my employee, not my company or contractor's employee. And this person basically shadows me, and their job is mostly to be on standby. Because if you look at doctors as a workplace, yes, oftentimes I'm on sets and at base. So I know base. I've got steps around base. I've got modifications at base. But base also still has a standard green room where I wouldn't be able to safely make a tea or coffee, because it's very difficult to get a company that is hiring a space to then modify the kitchen, for example. Mm. So I have in my dressing room a low kettle, low mugs, low sugar, low milk, so that I can reach everything. But my access support worker, for example, will fill my water supply every morning so that it's somewhere that I can reach it. My access support worker will shadow me when, for example, as an actor, you could end up on any set or location because you don't have that level of control in the workplace to go, oh, that house has door handles that are too high for me to reach. We can't film there. I can't really say that because I'm not part of the locations team. I'm dealing with enough learning X number of scripts in a week. So it's easier for me to employ an access support worker who will shadow me when we go to locations which I may have never visited before, so I don't know how accessible they are or they aren't. And that access support worker removes those barriers. So the most obvious one is we go film in an oldie worldie house, and the rooms that we're filming in have been decked out to look accessible for me and my character. Mm. So that's all believable. So the art department sometimes brings like door handles and things that are fake that they can then drop to my height, so my character is able to let herself in and out of spaces. But Hirana, the actress, might need to do a 10-1, which, by the way, is secret for needing to wee everybody, which always makes me giggle. Mm-hmm. But we all know what it means, but we all politely go 10-1. 10-1, everyone. I'm off for a 10-1. And it's like, I don't know why we don't all just go, I'm off for a wee, because it means the same thing. But anyway,
I know, humans are funny. It's so funny.
So, you know, my access support worker will often come to the toilet with me, and their job will literally be, can you guard the door? And make, because I can't reach the lock to lock the bathroom door. So your job is to stand guard and hold the door shut for me, you know, or can you reach the soap for me and things like that. Whereas I'm somebody that in my ordinary life, I don't need that kind of assistance because I've adapted my home. So, or my workplace has a set of steps so that I've, you know, like I've made modifications where I regularly am. But as an actor, I can't control the other environments that I'm not part of. What's gorgeous as well working on the soap is the art department have really got to know me. So they already in their heads are often problem solving in terms of prop choice. You know, they give me a rucksack that's the right size for me to carry. They give me a pair of scissors that are comfortable for me to chop something with. Like, you know, there's a real... And that's just because they've spent time with me. Like, I haven't needed to particularly educate them on that. Early on, I did have to reinforce to everyone that it was like, please ask me. If you ask me something inappropriate, I'll tell you it's inappropriate and not answer. But please don't be scared to ask me because you can't know everything. What's much harder for me is you working yourself up, preemptively solving a problem without consultation and giving me a solution that's much harder for me to work with than something I might have suggested, or even me telling you, actually, in that instance, that isn't a problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, things like that. So the classic for me is often as well a lot of products that are kind of advertised as disability aids because wheelchair users are still, you know, the poster child of disability in most places around the world. Well, you know, a wheelchair accessible toilet seat for me is 4 inches higher than I'm able to manage, whereas I've lived my life hopping on and off average height toilet seats.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. So that I'm fine with. You know, just things like that.
Hey, we are going to run out of time. It has been so...
Oh, my God, I just went for the clappers.
I know, it was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. It has been so glorious to speak to you. Thank you so much. I really hope the birds outside my house having a party haven't created a problem for us. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Oh, and I just wanted to say I'm absolutely delighted that the disability rights movement in Australia has really, you know, hit the ground running, campaigning for the NDIS. All of these things that I'm really seeing my sisters benefit from and their world be opened up by. Just don't let the non-disabled politicians tinker with it too much, because that's, again, where problems overseas in the UK, I've clocked them. Non-disabled people decide something's too generous and they start to meddle and they make a real hash of it. So that's the only piece of advice I can share.
Thank you so much. We so need to hear that right now. You're on 2RPH with Anthea Williams, listening to Sideshow. Now, Hannah, I believe this month you have two shows you're going to tell us about that you're not seeing, and one show that you are able to access.
This month, we're drawing to the end of Melbourne Fringe, and I've got two more picks that I won't be seeing, but I wish I could. So I hope some of you will get the chance to catch these works. First is Sheltered, written by and starring Catherine Hall and directed by Andy Snelling. Sheltered is a play following Catherine's hilariously honest take on the ups and downs of finding adulthood in a youth shelter while navigating cerebral palsy. Access details are on the Melbourne Fringe website, and an access pack is available on request. The final two shows are on October 20 and 22. My second choice is Deaf Enough, created and performed by Nathan Borg and presented by Sam Martin. Deaf Enough is a deaf-led conversation that will be told in Auslan by deaf queer actor and activist Nathan Borg. The October 20th session is already sold out, but tickets are still available for the 21st and 22nd of October. Both these shows are on at Festival Hub Trades Hall, with tickets and further info available at melbournefringe.com.au. Now, listeners may remember me recommending Kinetic Light's Work in Progress documentary online a few months ago. Well, now, they're having a rare screening of one of their famous works, Descent. This online screening will include all new access provisions, as well as a conversation between Kinetic Light founding artists Alice Shepherd, Michael Marg, and Laurel Lawson. It's on October 26 and 28, and will be available to watch back as on-demand viewing for 48 hours after the online screening. Tickets are a sliding scale starting at $0, and audiences can choose from four different access options, including ASL music interpretation and multiple types of audio description. Tickets and further information are available at www.tickettaylor.com/events/kinetic-light/102-1305.
Thanks, Hannah. They sound like great projects. Now, to take us out, we have the Psychotic Reactions with Take It Easy.